playback on RT Radio 1. Sponsored by the all-new Irish Times Weekend. With new writers like Marion Keyes and Sean Moncrief, your weekend's in good hands.
Good morning. Is there an ice cream or a bottle of water left in the country? Not to mention burgers and flagons of cider, as the heatwave has us barreling to the seaside, climbing mountains, jumping in lakes. Well, according to Met Aaron, there's more glorious sunshine on the way, but it's not all fun and games, and the state of absolute drought is putting severe pressure on businesses, farmers, fire and rescue services. At Duncannon Beach in County Wexford, six people had to be rescued after four-year-old twin sisters were blown out to sea on an inflatable Lilo. Hugh Burke and his neighbour decided to launch their own boats because they feared the emergency rescue services wouldn't get to the terrified little girls in time. He spoke with Mary Wilson.
What information were you armed with at this stage? You knew there were
only armed
two
with
girls.
The information that there was two girls had been blown out to sea on a Lilo from Duncannon Beach. Being local and just having come up off the beach a short time before, I knew which way the tide and wind were. So I knew the general direction they'd be travelling. They were heading out to sea.
So you launched your own boat?
Yeah, our two boats launched and we done parallel search about 200 yards between the boats so we could spot them. And as we rounded the fort in Duncannon, I spotted a windsurfer with a Lilo at the back of it. He was holding onto it. There was a swimmer in the water, but there was only one girl on the Lilo. So I made my way to them, and the other boat made their way to what they saw was a kayak towing somebody else in, a bit further over the beach. And I picked up the swimmer and the little girl, and we brought them to the shore. She was very frightened and in shock, but otherwise fine. When we got to the shore, then one of our shore crew informed me that there had been more people involved and one man was lying on the beach in a fairly distressed state. He was suffering from hypothermia. He was also going in and out of consciousness and he needed urgent medical assistance. The Coast Guard boat and the lifeboat arrived then within a few minutes on scene and they administered first aid, oxygen and all the first aid was needed and they were monitoring the man and the little girl. Lucky enough, we have a mobile lifeboat, a Land Rover. So some of our drivers are trained, first aid trainers, and we have an oxygen set in the Land Rover, a first aid kit as well, which was really an added value last night. We had enough first aiders to treat each one with oxygen.
Where was the second little girl?
The second little girl, she was sitting in a car when we got to the beach. Somebody had put her in a car, but she was very, very poorly. She was really cold and she was in shock. And she was vomiting up water.
And who was the man who was lying on the beach in a distressed
state? The man lying on the beach was the little girl's father. He had swam out and he had managed to reach the Lilo and taken one of the girls off it and tried to swim back to the shore, which was roughly about a half mile. But he got into difficulties on the way and both him and the little girl were going under. And this is when two other men entered the water and one of these men managed to get the little girl and get her back safely. The other guy got caught in the tide and was pulled away from everything and he was in difficulty. And that's when our local swimmer then, John Bourne, he got involved. He swam out and he got the father in and he also got the other man in. You know, it was a huge local community effort in the time that the lifeboat was on the way and the Coast Guard were on the way.
So we went from a situation, Hugh, where you had the two little girls on the Lilo and you ended up with, is it six casualties in the end?
Six casualties, yeah.
What an extraordinary night.
Exactly. But I'd love to get the message out about those airbeds. It's just, they're ideal for swimming pools, but nothing else.
Hugh Burke of the RNLI with Mary Wilson on Tuesday's Drive Time. Today, reporter Evelyn O'Rourke joined the lifeguards on Dollyman Strand to see the reality of life on Dublin's Baywatch.
Dollyman Beach Guards, Dublin Coast Guard Radio. Go ahead, over.
Dublin Coast Guard Radio, Dollymount Beach Guards. Good morning, sir. This is Dollymount Beach Guards.
We're on the Northwell Island, which is just between Clontarf and Raheny. It's actually the most protected piece of land as regards our wildlife and migratory bird in Ireland.
Your own job here then, because, well, I mean, I'm thinking you've the best job in Ireland this week. Tell us a little bit about your work.
Primarily, I manage the island here for the people of Dublin. So we have records of up to 10,000 people per day visiting us here. You can imagine the headache between public amenity and conservation. We would have antisocial behaviour at night time. We had it only 3 weeks ago at the end of the junior cert. We have this tradition now at this stage of burn the uniforms and burn the books. We had up to 100 gathered on the beach here, but we watch for this every year and we can plan before it actually happens.
In terms of barbecues, how big a deal has that been?
Technically, they're not allowed on the beach. We've had a couple of children actually stepping on barbecues. People have just put a bucket of sand over them and left them sitting there.
You and enjoying this heat wave, or is it just been insanely busy for you?
It has been quite busy, but it beats sitting here in the rain watching two people walk the beach.
Evelyn O'Rourke reporting from the front line at Dollyman Strand. Well, you may remember last week on Liveline, Sinead Johnson rang Jo from her bed in University Hospital Limerick during the heatwave. She was really uncomfortable and looking for an air conditioning unit, and Liveline listeners rang in with offers to help her. On Tuesday, Sinead's son Kieran rang Jo with an update on his mother's condition.
So Friday evening, she developed sepsis for the second time.
Oh, God.
And her temperature went sky high. It was 39.7. Her blood pressure dropped very low. She was very tachycardic. Basically, her heart was racing. And more or less, they had to put her on a range of antibiotics. And she got transferred then to the high dependency unit,
Okay. Which
would be a step down from ICU, which would be basically where they're ventilated. And to be honest, since then, she's deteriorated quite a lot as well.
Oh, my God.
Overnight on the Friday night, her hemoglobin had dropped from 11, which would be normal enough for a female, down to 7, which is incredibly low. And Sunday, she had to receive 2 units of blood transfusions, basically, to try and bring that up. She's got severe photophobia. She's very unwell. And to be quite honest, she's fearful that she's going to die. And myself, looking at her, she looks like she is. And to be quite honest, I've also been informed by a senior consultant that he also has written to the Minister of Health a number of weeks back, basically stating that the Limerick University Hospital is the most dangerous hospital he's had to work in over 30 years of his experience. Mm.
Now, Kieran, your mother was saying on Friday
that
she was desperately unhappy with the heat was the thing and the fact that nothing had been done.
It's the heat and the lack of management and the pressure the staff, both doctors, nurses, care assistants are all under to provide care for patients. It's a difficult enough job to provide proper care for patients. But when you're under that amount of pressure, corners are cut. It's so unfair, and for the staff to be working in 42 degree temperatures, it's cruel.
From Liveline with Joe Duffy. Meanwhile, far away in Thailand came the extraordinary story of 12 teenagers and their football coach found alive in a cave by British divers after they'd gone missing in monsoon floods for 10 days. This was the moment they were found.
Thank you.
Hello, thank you.
How many of you? 13. Brilliant.
Yeah.
We are coming. It's okay.
It's okay.
Many people are coming.
Many, many people.
We are the first. Many people come.
What day?
Tomorrow.
No. What day is it?
Now
I'm
asking.
Monday.
Monday.
Okay, but 1 week and Monday. You have been here 10 days. 10 days. You are very strong. Very strong.
But 5 days later, their ordeal is far from over, and efforts to rescue them from the narrow underground cave system has already led to the death of a Navy SEAL diver. It will be a major challenge to get them out safely. Channel 4's Jonathan Miller is at the mouth of that cave in Thailand, from where he spoke with Mary Wilson.
Saman Gunan was a former Navy SEAL diver from Thailand with many, many years' experience. And he was in the cave about a mile in at about 2 o'clock in the morning today, and he lost consciousness and efforts to resuscitate him failed, and his body was brought out and he was given a guard of honour and flown back home. Now, I mean, this only serves to underscore the enormity of the danger facing the boys if they attempt a similar dive out. The colleagues of the dead man basically said that we're not going to let his life be in vain, and there is a real determination to see this through, but you know, the options are really, really not good. I mean, the weather still hasn't turned for the worse, but it's expected soon to start monsooning down again. They're pumping water out as fast as they can, but there are still large sections off the passageway submerged. The boys will have to dive, it looks like. They haven't found an alternative route, one of these chimneys or sinkholes from up above. So it's touch and go, really, and I would expect within the next 24 hours or so that we may well see an attempt to bring some of these boys out.
Have they talked through the complexities of trying to take 12 boys who we understand can't swim, have no diving experience, from that cave through these dark tunnels to try and get them to safety?
look at the videos that the Thai Navy SEALs are taking, it shows how awful these claustrophobic tunnels are. You know, they're submerged sometimes totally, sometimes up to neck deep. It's incredibly claustrophobic. And there are rocks and sharp fragments and twists and turns and ups and downs. It's incredibly difficult.
Jonathan Miller reporting for Drive Time last night. Well, Olympic silver medalist Annalise Murphy knows all about challenges. Olympic sailing has been her life for the past 9 years. But last October, she set off from Alicante to take part in the Volvo Ocean Race, an experience she described as daunting but addictive. She went from onshore racing in a dinghy to offshore racing in a 5-men, 5-women team. Annalise was Ray Darcy's guest on Monday.
How physical is it?
Physically, you train for it. So I did loads of gym training beforehand. And the main thing you're doing is stacking. So you're moving sails from one side of the boat to the other. You're moving them forwards, you're moving them backwards.
So for somebody who hasn't done that, what's the equivalent of on land? Is it like
basically just
carrying bricks or?
Lifting really heavy, awkward objects around the place on a moving platform.
Okay.
So we spend, sometimes our stack on the longer legs was 2,000 kilos. And every time you do a tack or a jibe, you need to move that all from one side of the boat to the other. So you kind of grew to hate that kind of side of it. But
you were getting stronger as you went along, were you?
You weren't really, though, because you're only getting about 4 hours
sleep
a day.
Yes. What about
and you're eating
food?
Freeze-dried food. And like, I just started living off Haribo's and Nutella because I stopped liking freeze-dried
very
food.
Healthy.
Very healthy. Yeah.
did you say to Niamh that if you have to eat freeze-dried food, you advise that you do it in the dark?
Yeah, exactly.
Why so?
Like, if you have a look at it, it looks like puke, basically.
Right.
So the best way to do is to not look at what you're eating, and also don't read the ingredients, because my favourite meal, I read the ingredients on the back. It was 40% processed cheese powder, and then there was like 20 different ingredients after that, and I thought, I actually can't eat this anymore. And that was my favourite meal. So it was
surely they could do better than that. No,
like some of the boys on the boat, they loved the freeze-dried meals.
Right.
Like some of them were saying they were bringing them on shore because it meant they didn't have to cook, they could just boil a kettle.
Boys will be boys.
Yeah.
Boys will be boys. So was there any time, you mentioned that the leg from Australia up to Hong Kong and then back down to Auckland.
Yeah.
Was that one of the toughest, two of the toughest legs?
I think probably from Melbourne to Hong Kong, the first 5 days were fine. And then we hit the doldrums and for 5 days we didn't move. The water temperature was 37 degrees and the air temperature was 42. And we were in no wind, drifting, doing like 20 to 30 miles a day.
And no land?
No land. And we saw the Solomon Islands actually.
No, but for most of the time,
yeah,
you had a 360 degree horizon of
the sea
and the sky.
It was so hot. And we were all sleeping, because there's no wind, you sleep on the floor up in the bow. So you're sleeping on the hard ground, the carbon fibre. And I just thought, I do not want to be here.
And there must be a boredom factor, is there?
Well, there is and there isn't. Like you're trying to get your sleep. And when it's that hot, I discovered it was better not to sleep for one of your off watches, that you tried to stay awake for one. And then So you'd be really tired.
Ah, yes.
And you'd be more likely to sleep on the other two.
Yeah.
Annalise Murphy heard on The Ray Darcy Show. It was just devastating listening to Emma Vicfahuna talking to Miriam O'Callaghan. The terminally ill mother of five settled her case against the HSE and a US laboratory for €7.5 million last week. But on Thursday, she revealed that her cancer had spread to her brain. She's now in hospital and can't tolerate any treatment because she also suffers from Crohn's disease. But as she told Miriam, she's not scared. Just heartbroken.
It's the not knowing and trying to explain to my children, if I have a seizure, this is what you have to do and this is who you have to ring. And it's just so uncertain, and I don't like the unpredictability, and I don't like how quick it's going. And it's just, I suppose, I just have no control over it. Like, in some ways, I just wish it was all over.
As you say, you very great people around you, Emma, don't you, who can support you yourself?
Yeah, sure. Like, the government is behind me. The HSE is behind me. The president is behind me. The media, my family, my friends, my children. Like, it's like I have so much support there, but it's just one of them things. It just brings it back home about, like, negligence and... Like, the 7.5 million doesn't make any differences to me. Like, I just went in there and I wasn't taking any nonsense because I wanted my children taken care of. Like, every mouth guard, every football boots adds up. Like, do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It sounds a lot, but when you divide it down to four boys and one girl, it's a lot. So I kind of had that box ticked where I was taking care of them financially and I felt that they should pay for it. But it just brings it back home to what happens when a test is wrong. And like, not all of us are the same where that we can take immuno drugs. So it's just... it's just like a nice process to be in, to be honest. And there's times when I break down and I can do it now because my children aren't around. But when I'm around them, I just kind of have to stay really happy. But it's just so wrong. I just hope there's like changes in the test that this doesn't happen to other women, because I wouldn't wish this on anyone. Like
Emma Vicfahuna heard on the Today Show on Thursday. You know, it should have been so easy for Taoiseach Leo Varadkar out there in New York promoting Ireland and meeting the next generation of young Irish leaders at a private lunch party. But his reported remarks sympathising with Donald Trump's view on the trivialisation of politics by the media, he claimed that political journalists were more interested in gossip at Dáil Éireann than in the workings of government, ensured a frosty reception from the press corps and political opponents when he got back here. Ellen Coyne broke the story, along with Simon Carswell of the Irish Times. She joined Miriam O'Callaghan and her panel on the gathering yesterday.
It isn't a row with like fragile snowflakes like me in Leinster House getting upset because the Taoiseach doesn't like me. The reason the story was important was because he did align himself with Donald Trump. He said, I sympathise with his view on the media. And you had Colm Brophy in this studio on Wednesday morning assuring you that me and Simon Carswell had taken it out of context. Leaders' questions came and went. And the Taoiseach never actually addressed the Trump thing. He talked about the comments he made about us, that there's too many of us, that we focus on gossip in the corridors. But he never actually addressed the real reason that that story was a public interest story. And actually, he was the one who turned it into a tittle-tattle thing.
I would say, I imagine that if Leo still harbours some of those views secretly, that he mightn't feel entirely unjustified in holding them. Because here's a throwaway, with all respect, and it was a great story, but a throwaway comment at a private dinner has been dominating the news agenda for a week. That's not to justify what he said, though, because aligning yourself with Donald Trump is politically toxic. Donald Trump's issues with the media are because, as Neil said, they're the only ones who are holding him to account for his racism, for his behaviour, for his finances, for his lies. And for any politician who expects to be held in any kind of esteem to say, I sympathise with Donald Trump, are just words that should never have come out of his mouth.
And it wasn't a throwaway because he said it twice.
Journalists Brenda Power and Ellen Coyne heard on the Today Show yesterday. Last week's documentary on One explored the mysterious inner soundtrack of people who have tinnitus, the experience of hearing ringing, buzzing, or other sounds that don't have an external source. While many of those who spoke have found a path to coping with these sounds, we heard of one case where a family was tragically affected by the very worst of tinnitus. In 2015, Welshman James Ivor Jones took his life after he could no longer bear the suffering caused by tinnitus and also a related condition called hyperacusis, which is an extreme sensitivity to sound. His son, Wesley Jones, read from a letter that James wrote to his family.
I'm really struggling with tinnitus this last month. My ears feel raw and sensitive to ordinary sounds, and the tinnitus has mostly moved up inside my head. Metal filings falling loudly onto a tin roof, and a high-pitched continuous ringing, sizzling, and a low-pitched drone in the background. It feels as though I'm wearing a headband which tingles around my temples. My feet feel hot and tingly, through anxiety, I think, and I'm feeling sick with nausea. This is truly awful. As hard as I try to be positive and to get back on track, it just gets worse. Even talking irritates my ears. The audiologists say they don't think I have hyperacusis because it's very rare, and I hoped that they were right. But it's got so bad it seems like I have a hole in both sides of my head. Even a teaspoon clanking against the cup is painful. The tinnitus is bad enough on its own, and I feel like I'm between a rock and a hard place. In addition, I feel this anxiety and I'm permanently on edge. I don't know if it's the medication or if those glands are overproducing, but it's really pulling me down. I feel like I'm being tortured, and there is no cure. Please forgive me if I can't cope. I don't want to die, or to leave, or to hurt the people I love. But I cannot live with this progressive and increasingly difficult condition. I can't take any more. Please forgive me.
Wesley Jones there reading from a suicide note written by his father. Well, Wesley spoke with eloquence and devotion about his father, and he also gave these three pieces of advice on tinnitus.
At the end of my conversation with Wesley, he asked to say three things.
I guess to people that don't have tinnitus, I'd say to cherish the fact that you can listen to silence and that that's a choice. To anyone that knows someone with tinnitus, take them seriously, be there for them. And anyone who does have tinnitus and who is thinking that they can't go on, just try and keep your hope alive. There's people working on this, there's people researching it. You never know what tomorrow could bring. Just keep the hope alive.
And that excerpt was from last week's documentary on One White Noise, which was narrated by Orla Higgins, who also co-produced it with Kevin Brew. And if you've been affected by anything you heard there, you can contact the Samaritans at Freephone 116 123. That's Freephone 116 123. When Hollywood film stars Carrie Fisher and Debbie Reynolds died within hours of each other 2 years ago, there was a huge sadness among fans around the world. My Girls is the title of Todd Fisher's memoir about his mother and sister, and he describes it as a long love letter and thank you note to them. Todd was Ryan Tuberty's guest yesterday, and he had a fantastic store of anecdotes about Elizabeth Taylor, Richard Burton, Eddie Fisher and their crazy shenanigans. The name dropping was Olympian. But he also spoke of going to the premiere of Star Wars with Princess Leia herself.
It's interesting that you say, Todd, Postcards from the Edge and the books were what brought peace in terms of some sort of competitive peace in the valley, if you like. You skip over Princess Leia and Star Wars because, much like Alec Guinness, who was Obi-Wan Kenobi in the movie, as I understand it from a previous interview, Carrie was kind of sceptical as to the success and the possibilities of success from this bizarre film about people in the sky fighting and what have you. She was kind of doubtful, wasn't she?
Well, yeah. I mean, look, I visited her in London when they were making the film and, you know, the sets were pretty impressive, but, you know, you couldn't see anything. There's no effects. It's just blue screen. So you don't see any of the star fields. You don't see any of the things blowing up or the spaceships, you know, and you see a giant carpet walking around that doesn't talk. I mean, people were beginning to question whether Lucas was insane. The studio pulled the plug. If it wasn't for Francis Ford Coppola guaranteeing the completion of the film, it probably wouldn't have happened. You know, and the explanation is he's making essentially a Western movie in outer space, you know, with the cowboys with white and black hats. It's very similar. And I mean, nobody understood what was coming at all. And Carrie was certainly wondering herself. In fact, she said she thought this could be the end of her acting career because the hairdo and you know, talking to this guy in a black helmet. Until the opening night where we went to 20th Century Fox and she was out in the parking lot, very nervous and chain smoking and drinking a Coca-Cola. And, you know, they're getting ready to start the film. And I'm like, hey, we got to go sit down. And she's like, no, wait till the lights go down. She didn't even want to be seen. She was so embarrassed for what was about to occur. So we snuck in after the movie started. We ended up having to sit in the front row and she's got a hold of my hand and she's crushing my hand. She's so nervous. And then that battle cruiser flies over. And I looked at her and I said, wow, this is no B movie. And, you know, and then she kind of took a deep breath and we both watched that movie. You know, even at that moment, you didn't realize that it was going to be historical in the sense of how it changed filmmaking. We still thought, wow, that was impressive. But we didn't know until a few days later. We were over at Grauman's Chinese Theater for that premiere and people were sleeping in sleeping bags on the sidewalk.
Todd Fisher heard on the Ryan Tuberty Show yesterday. Another famous family featured on the Today Show. Indaba Mandela was born in Soweto in 1982 under the apartheid regime. His grandfather, Nelson Mandela, was finally released from prison in 1990, having spent 27 years in captivity. Indaba would eventually go to live with his granddad, and his new book, Going to the Mountain, details that time.
You went to live with him, I think, after his release in 1990. Why did that come about? Why did you leave your own family?
Well, it was not my choice, to be honest with you. My grandfather, I remember I had just come home from school. It was about 2-3 in the afternoon. And of course, I was alone playing with my friends because our parents only get home in the evening around 6-7. So this black BMW pulled up as we were playing marbles outside my house. And the gentleman hopped out and he came straight to me and he said, "Are you Ndaba?" I said, "Yes." And he said, "Well, I've been sent by grandfather to come and fetch you. Please let us go." And I said, "No, I'm not going to go with you." I mean, I had not heard or seen my grandfather since that day he was released from prison. So it was very strange and odd that all of a sudden, out of the blue, without me knowing or my parents knowing that, you know, there's this gentleman who's been sent to come and fetch me. And the gentleman was really, really at odds and found that very odd that I would, you know, deny him. "Do you have any idea of who your grandfather is? Do you want me to lose my job? Please, let's go at once." And I said, "Sorry, sir, I cannot." And eventually the man gave up and he left. And so when my parents came home that evening, I, you know, told my father what had transpired. And he said to me, "Well, if the man comes again, you should go with him." Lo and behold, the man came back that very same week. And of course, I went with him and he took me to my grandfather's house where he lived at the time, which was a leafy white suburb in northern Johannesburg. And, you know, it was a very, very different, you know, you go through the gate, the security, you go into the house, you know, there's chefs cooking people, the staff, there's just so many staff in the house. And eventually met the old man. And of course, he then, you know, was very warm and they gave me something to eat. And he then told me that, you know, my parents would be going to university to study. And while they are at university, I would be staying with him because he wants my parents to focus at university. And I mean, as in the African home, you don't really ask questions; you just do as you're told. So I didn't have much choice. I couldn't say anything or even question it. And my father came the next day, and basically they had a discussion, and he confirmed what my grandfather told me the previous day.
So your father and mother, then, they understood. Were they upset losing you, or they were happy with this arrangement?
Well, to be honest, I don't remember any sort of emotion from my dad, but I could definitely tell you that my mother was very sad. She was very sad, and I really missed her those years, to be honest with you.
Ndaba Mandela, heard on the Today Show with Miriam O'Callaghan. The second series of Like Family began on Wednesday night at 10, with more Irish people finding their life partners around the world. Brenda Donoghue explored the idea of global romance, and she wondered, where do the children of these relationships feel most at home? Ruth Medjbear works internationally as a music photographer under her brand Ruthless Imagery. She cut her teeth at Hot Press magazine, and her work has since been published in Rolling Stone, NME, and she's also the official festival photographer for the Electric Picnic, all very high profile. Ruth's mother is from Dublin, her dad is from Algeria. She was born in Ireland and says she's most at home in Merino in Dublin. But some people she meets casually assume that someone with her surname and her appearance couldn't really be a dub.
So you give your name, it doesn't matter who you're talking to, and then they get a little pause and you see it on their face, the question's creeping over their face, and they go, "And where's that from then?" And then you're just, you
and
go...
And what do you say? So here I am, where's that from, Ruth?
So dad's Algerian. Yeah. It's an Algerian surname. That's it. And then the questions, some of the questions after that get ridiculous. Because, you know, some people's instant question after that is like, "Oh, right. And did you ever get to meet your dad?" As if he came over here, knocked up my mum and legged it. Like, that's their first thing that they think of. And I'm like, yeah, I get to meet him every day. He's at home cooking dinner at the moment. Like.
From Brenda Donoghue's series, Like Family, last Wednesday night. It's just over a fortnight ago since Taoiseach Leo Varadkar made an historic apology in the Dáil to men who were criminalised because of their homosexuality before the law was repealed.
"I was just a child when Declan Flynn was murdered in Fairview Park, his only crime being that he was gay. He was brutally attacked by five young men, one a teenager, who shouted, 'Hide behind a tree, we're going to bash a queer.' He died from asphyxia after being given a horrific beating by those men. Because when the Oireachtas make something a crime, people believe that they have a license to punish those who they believe are committing it. And these were young men who grew up in a society which feared and hated homosexuality. They took the law into their own hands. And all too often, people allowed the law to do its bashing for them.
In that speech, Taoiseach made particular mention of Declan Flynn, who was savagely beaten to death with sticks by a gang of five in Fairview Park in Dublin in 1982. This so-called queer bashing spree and the fact that his killers, although found guilty, walked free from court because the judge insisted they came from good homes, led to a massive demonstration on the streets of Dublin, and Declan became a symbol for the gay rights movement in this country. Declan Flynn came from a big family. His brother Chris is the eldest of nine, and he told Miriam O'Callaghan about his younger brother.
He unfortunately got the short end of the stick of life because he had a very bad speech impediment and he was left-handed. They tried to beat that out of him in school. He really didn't succeed in the educational system at the time. So he ended up, I suppose, not achieving what he wanted to achieve in life. He had a job in St. Brendan's in Grange Gorman, and then the final job he had was in Erine in Dublin Airport, which he actually loved. He loved that particular job. But I think the speech impediment led to him being bullied in a few places, not just in school, but afterwards. He was very open-hearted. He really was. He loved Christmas, I think, as my nephew said. And he'd go to extreme lengths to make sure that everyone had a present at Christmas time, wrapped and tagged. So he was a gentle person. He was shy in company, but he had tremendous heart. The second youngest in the family was Down syndrome, brother Gregory, and there's a special relationship between the two of them. Declan shared the particular love of music that he had, particularly Elvis, with Gregory. No accounting for taste, perhaps, but they really got on very well together, and he looked after Greg in a special way. So he was probably unique within the family. You know, he wasn't able to stand up for himself like the rest of us. So we kind of cared about him in a special way, I suppose. Mm.
It's 36 years since Declan Flynn was murdered, and Chris remembers the court case well.
The judge, basically, Sean Gannon, said because they came from good homes that they didn't need to serve time.
Yeah, I was in the court when he started summing up, and I knew which way he was going to go. And I just said to some of my siblings, come on, we'll leave it, because the Black Mariah was outside on the keys and the police prosecution fully expected that they would be taken off to prison. And while it's a gross insult to Declan, I felt at the time, for my father particularly, who'd be a very law and order, straight down the middle kind of individual, and he expected justice to be done that day. It wasn't done that day. Sean Gannon let them walk out, and effectively, as I think David Norris said afterwards, a license apparently was issued that this was okay. I felt angrier towards Sean Gannon than I did towards the five guys, I have to say.
What about your parents? How do they deal with that?
Both of them very religious, very Catholic. My mother never got over it, but I think, you know, her religion stood to her at the time. My father couldn't understand it, you know. He just could not compute that the system that he had so much faith in, I suppose, had disregarded the value of his son in such a way, you know.
Had they been aware, because it's way back in 1982, that Declan was gay?
No. No, we weren't aware of that at the time. He had a good social life, we were aware of that. But, you know, I can't say that I ever met the friends that he would have socialised. I know he went to the Hirschfield Centre. David Norris told me that afterwards. It was after Declan's death. So no, there was no consciousness around the family of that.
And yet, the extraordinary thing, there was a huge protest. I mean, people do say, when you look back on it now, that moment, and probably that's why Leo Varadkar mentioned it in the Dáil, it did change things, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. And I mean, things moved on from that.
I know you say you're still grieving Declan's death, but the fact that he is now being remembered and it's such a positive influence, in a sense, that tragedy has had on Ireland today, is that any comfort?
I'm not sure that it is. I mean, I know, you know, there are seven people still grieving in the Flynn family over his death and the brutal manner in which it happened. To this day, they're still grieving. You know, they're still getting over what happened over 30 years ago.
Chris Flynn, heard there on the Today Show with Miriam O'Callaghan. When Sebastian Barry started out as a writer 40 years ago, he said he might have got a few letters from his readers. These days, he rejoices in meeting them face to face at festivals and signings and hearing their valuable feedback. The Laureate for Literature was Miriam O'Callaghan's guest on Wednesday, and he laid out his stall for his new role. He's planning a series of book club gatherings in unusual venues.
This idea actually was born of an incredibly life-changing moment when Jim Collerton of Fishamble brought my little play on Blueberry Hill into Mountjoy. And that play is set in Mountjoy, but what do I know about that? You know, I'm the idiot walking the dog along the Royal Canal years ago, looking over at the old mansion and thinking, how are they getting on in there? So we brought this play in. We were told possibly, you know, that the young men might be restless, they might make noise, you know, don't be upset. But the silence of those men listening to this play was quite extraordinary. And there's a little moment in the play where Niall Buggy, playing his role, says that he never sees his children, but that's all right because your children are inside you, so you'll always have them with you. Mm. There was a man in front of me whose head just went down a fraction of an inch in a certain momentous way. It was so private, but I was watching him maybe almost wrongly. But that experience, no one is a fan of locking people up or keeping people anywhere. In truth, I'm a tutuist, like in Bishop Tutu sense. I believe in reconciliation, the village meeting, deciding what to do, the person apologising and people being contained within the community. OK, so maybe that's a bit quixotic, I'm not sure. But I then was thinking of places, and next year I hope to go to some prisons again with the book club. But this year, with the help of the amazing Marcella Bannon at the Arts Council and Sarah Bannon, to try and get to people who are constrained in other slightly different ways. Mm. And two of these book clubs will be in dialysis units, renal dialysis, one in Waterford, one in Cork. And I'm also going to go into the Central Mental Hospital. People are familiar perhaps with that high wall in Dundrum, mm-hmm. very intimidating wall. They are our people, we are part of them. So I'm going to go in my own, you know, foolish way. Maybe it means nothing in the grand scheme of things, but it's what I can do.
Sebastian Barry heard on the Today Show on Wednesday. The American writer Ben Rhodes says his early working life in Washington during the Bush years was spent just one degree removed from people in rooms making decisions that were changing lives. He also felt they were the wrong people. And that's what encouraged him to go to work for Barack Obama's campaign at the age of 29. He went on to become his speechwriter and deputy foreign policy advisor during the 8 years of the Obama presidency. He's just written a memoir about those years. Ben Rhodes was Ryan Tuberty's guest on Tuesday.
The sight of President Obama roasting Trump at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, where he just kept going and going and going at him. In a way, now we look back and say, that was, you know, people have said, well, you know, Ben, that was one of the moments where Trump said, I'll get you. I will make you, you know, march under the yoke yeah. of your own White House. Where were you that night of the roasting? Did you write any of the gags? And were you happy with his performance?
Well, you know, I was there at that dinner, but the reality was the next day was the Osama bin Laden operation. Yeah. And so that's all I was thinking about. I had been in these secret meetings for weeks planning this bin Laden operation. We all had to go to that dinner. None of us wanted to go because we knew that we were trying to keep this secret and all the Washington journalists were going to be there. And if none of the national security people showed up, they'd figure out something was going on. So we go to the dinner, and I knew he was going to do that with Trump. You always kind of tell jokes at that dinner.
Yeah.
It's an annual affair. And Trump had just done the whole birther thing. And so Obama had been forced to release his birth certificate, frankly, because our media was far too willing to give Trump a platform to say Obama wasn't born in the United States. And so that was the context. Obama was very annoyed that why does he as an African-American have to do what no white president had to do, release a birth certificate to prove he was born in the United States. And so he had some fun with Trump. I remember just thinking, like, how is Obama pulling this off when he knows the next day he's got to get up and preside over this very risky operation? You know, I've heard people say that, you know, maybe that got Trump into it. The reality is, if Trump was that upset by that performance. He could have run for president against Obama in 2012, but he opted out of that. The jokes hold up pretty well, if anybody wants to go back and check it out. And the Bin Laden operation, of course, turned out well, too.
Obviously, Trump gets elected. We don't need to relive all of that. But I watched the documentary, the final year, and you feature so prominently in that, as does Samantha Power. Your reaction to the Trump election, where you can't even talk. You were so distressed. It was like you got punched really hard. And you've watched that back.
Yeah, no. And look, I think the reality is, look, if a Republican had gotten elected, it would have been one thing. You know, I would have been happy. But, you know, Trump's election was something different. It was like learning something about your country and foreseeing a future that was so much the opposite of everything we had worked for 8 years under Obama, that, you know, anything I said in that moment, I would have been trying to convince myself that maybe it wasn't that bad. I mean, it was that bad. And sometimes things are not going to be okay. And that was one of those times.
From the Ryan Tuberty Show on Tuesday. Well, Richard Curran opened his show last Saturday with a really interesting interview with Mary McKenna, the founder and CEO of Tour America. Mary is steeped in the travel industry, and after a few years working for different companies, Mary struck out on her own 23 years ago, and her company has never failed to turn a profit. Towards the end of their conversation, Richard focused in on a pivotal moment in Mary's life that prompted her to reevaluate how she works day to day.
2004, you were involved in a terrible accident.
Yes.
What happened?
So it was a Saturday. I used to work weekends, and a beautiful sunny day in January the 24th. And I was at the back of the office. Our office is actually quite long. It goes from the front of Abbey Street to the back. So it's quite deceptive. It looks small, but it's a huge, huge building. And my office was at the very back. I actually saw an old lady trying to park her car, and I said, she'll never get it in there. So I went out, moved my car, turned around, and this Mercedes Jeep, I just saw it, and I knew, I actually thought I was dead. I said, I'm gone. And it knocked me down.
You were just getting out of your car.
I just had turned around, and it just smacked me, and I went up in the air, and it ran over me. The Jeep ran over the back of me. I was very lucky it didn't go over my head. So I broke all my ribs, and my ribs went into my lungs, and I fractured my pelvis and hip and tore my liver.
So you were conscious during all of
this? I was. But it's funny the way your mind operates. I really was very happy to be alive, and I realised I was a total survivor. And they told me later that I had 50-50 chance of survival, and that most people would die from my injuries. But the fact I didn't put pressure on my heart saved my life. So I was kind of thinking, I'm never going to walk again. My back's broken, my legs are broken. But, you know, and I was literally going into survival mode. And my life changed that day, really. I was very happy. You know, if I had died that day, I had a great life. But, you know, I no longer work weekends. I have a great family. I'm very conscious of being grateful for everything. And I'm truly grateful to be alive. And I have a great attitude about everything now.
Tour America CEO Mary McKenna heard on The Business with Richard Curran. But I'll leave you now with an old favourite from Bagatelle, which I heard on Liveline's Funny Friday yesterday. Gurmag of Asur Goluther, Kazian Sachtan Johagin, Gijeshib Slan.
Take me away from the city, lead me to where I can be on my own. I wanted to see you now that I have. Just wanna be left alone. I'll always remember your kind words. I still remember your name. But I've seen you change and turn.